Okay, we'll have, are you guys, can you guys come talk to us after, let me open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue and open a work session on Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 152. So, committee, we're returning to these bills. These are obviously the large, although not the extent of which, that the bonding bills that we're going to get, but they're certainly the lion's share of both GO bonds and lottery bonds. And our task, again, is to understand the projects, but really amend this bill if we believe necessary on the overall level of debt, both on the GO side and the lottery side, and find that proper level and that number, and that is the key, the number that we would amend into the bill and send down to Ways and Means. The co-chairs have a number that definitely got a lot of folks' attention, and this is our entree and opportunity to take a look at that number and weigh in and suggest our own number and amend it into the bill. And with that, Paul, you've done some work in LRO taking a look at what came out last week and things for us to consider. And I'll turn it over to Paul and Mazin, who've been working on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. Mazin and I have been looking at the information, really the information that the committee was presented, as well as construction budget numbers that we could gather from the co-chair's budget. First thing, the information in the co-chair's budget isn't directly comparable to the bond capacity. It's really looking at the debt service level. And, of course, from the standpoint of the Ways and Means Committee, the key issue for them is not only the debt capacity, but looking at what economists would call the opportunity cost of that debt service. Because if you're paying debt service, then you don't have dollars for operational expenses. And that's kind of the trade-off that they're really weighing, I think, is what drove a lot of this discussion around the co-chair's debt service number. And Mazin has copied the co-chair's chart on the construction budget showing about $56 million in debt service payments. But it also, you notice there's a block there that says pending debt management information from revenue committees. And what we are going to recommend is that the committee really look at the overall bond capacity numbers and discussion that you got from the Treasurer and from Department of Administrative Services. And so we reproduced a couple of the handouts that were in Laura Lockwood McCall's report from the Debt Advisory Committee. And the first one is on the factors that could impact general fund supported debt capacity. And that's copied there, and you can see that's, and you may remember Laura walking through this with you, where she talked about the base case, looking out over 6 years and the current forecast horizon, and then arriving at a number based on a percentage of general fund. These are for the GO bonds. And the number that they said would be within the realm of prudent management was $789 million on a per biennium basis. And then the governor's supported debt in 07-09, the general fund supported debt was $711 million, so it was within that particular measure. Our recommendation, really based on the discussion that you had as a committee, is to perhaps look at a more a stricter kind of guideline in terms of what would be kind of a scenario in which you would want to base that debt capacity on. And one that stands out obviously to us is the 10% decline scenario that Laura has provided and that the Debt Advisory Committee looked at, and notice the difference there. That's assuming that general fund revenue is 10% lower than projected over the six-year period. And you can see that if you use that approach, it's $595 million rather than the $789 million. And that would put you below where the governor's recommended level is, but it may be something you'd want to consider as a more, as a tighter limit on the debt capacity based on what we don't think is going to happen, but certainly within the realm of possibility, having 10% less in revenue. Remember that we did drop 20% below our projections in 2001-03. This is a six-year period, so it should cover a longer period of business cycle, so we don't think that risk is really severe. But you could also see some longer-term scenarios of a very stagnant economy, very low inflation, or even perhaps deflation, and the kinds of things that could cause general fund revenue to drop that much below over an extended period. So the risks are clearly out there. And perhaps that with the committee would want to look at that, or the other thing that we could do for you would be to look at some other percentages that if you would feel more comfortable with even a worst-case scenario or something that's between the 10% and the base case. So that's kind of what we're thinking on. That's on the general fund.
So the GO, Mazin.
There's also a lottery segment of this, Mr. Chair. The lottery segment, we also went with the 10% decline, not necessarily because of the same idea of the recession or the lower amounts, but the lottery has a different level of risks and different structural risk if we as we analyze this is not necessarily the economy not performing, but this is a competition that might be presented for this and we compare that to a company or a firm as in the lotteries type of competition versus an industry when you're talking about the general economy and the general fund type. So this firm, which is the Oregon Lottery, would probably be presented within its environment with a lot more competition in the coming few years than we are used to in this time. So if that happens, that probably would put a lot more pressure on the amounts of revenue and what kind of coverage this revenue would be able to support as in bonds. So that's why we would feel that a prudent recommendation on this line is to go with a 10% decline. That's also the 402 million rather than the 443 or the 486 constitutes the 5%.
Questions for Paul and Mazin, Senator George.
I thought the governor's numbers were very conservative before, and so I guess my first question, if I could, was, what's the difference? I mean, I just took the low 10% decline number on both of them. I get $997 million between a combination of the both of them. How does that compare with what the co-chairs established? When I first saw the number, I was kind of in shock. Do you have what numbers they're proposing for both lottery and general fund?
I think Mazin could address this too, Senator, but our understanding is that, as I said, these numbers are not directly comparable to a debt capacity level, or more in terms of a debt service payment. And that could be dependent on a number of things, for example, when the bonds are issued during the biennium. So it's not a directly comparable number in terms of what that would translate into. So what our intent is to get a sense when we get a decision from you, a recommendation from you in terms of what you're comfortable with a debt capacity level, is to work with them and then to translate that into what that debt service might look like. But I'm pretty certain it would probably be higher than this number here in terms of the debt service. But again, it depends on, I mean, if you're issuing the debt January 1, 2009, then you're not going to have much debt service payment in 2007-2009. So there's a lot of variability within those numbers.
Well, in that point, if I could complete, the second question was that we know that if we go ahead with all the capital construction, you know, for community colleges and universities, we're going to have a staging of that. They're not going to have projects ready. So is it possible for the legislature to come back and say, whoops, we made a mistake, we're going to have to stop from this point on and not issue any more bonds? We can do that, correct?
That is possible to do that. That's within the discretion of the Treasurer in terms of the timing of issuance. But I think the key for you as you think about the decision to make here is to look at the longer term. We've got these six-year projections. In fact, we could even argue maybe we should go longer than that to look out and see what the revenue stream is, and then to determine what would be a responsible debt capacity that you as a legislature would want to give as a target to the Ways and Means Committee. And then the timing of that can vary, but if you give an overall long-run target, then that's a pretty clear indication of what they shouldn't go above.
The last question.
Please.
Perfect lead-in, Paul. Thank you. And that is, we know very well that we're going to need a substantial increase in capacity within the community college universities for everything that we're working on in this building relative to getting a workforce trained up and ready to go. The opportunity lost, the cost of not doing this now, we know that the construction costs are going to continue to accelerate. I mean, it's hard to see any scenario in which construction costs are going to go down. Aggregate costs are going down, concrete, I mean, are not going to go down. The cost of concrete is not going to go down. You know, the cost of labor is not going to go down. So I think we need to consider, too, the idea that, my goodness sakes, if you don't invest now, you're going to pay a lot later. Comment
that,
on that.
Senator George, I think that is the costs are a critical factor in how those would accelerate over time. But kind of the way we've thought about it and talked about it is, you know, you think of production of anything, widgets or producing educated young adults. You want to have the proper mix of labor and capital, and if you don't, you're going to be inefficient. So if you have less than the optimal amount of capital, then you're not going to be as productive as you should be. So that's the key decision, I think. And I mentioned earlier about this trade-off between, you know, kind of this operating revenue, discretionary revenue versus, you know, commitment to debt service, and that is definitely a trade-off. Mm-hmm. But the benefit of doing that is having the capital there that would make your workforce more productive and the quality of your product better. So that's the kind of trade-off I think that the Ways and Means Committee needs to look at is what is the, you know, how much bang do you get for that additional capital, and is it worth more than, you know, then you could spend it in another way. Obviously, capital is critical. I mean, capital is the reason why the advanced economies have a lot higher standard of living than the developing economies. It is the primary reason. Workers produce more with better capital, and that's just, we know that that's a basic tenet of economics.
Thank you.
Other question? Yes, Mazin.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the co-chairs budgets, when you look at the amounts of it, they have allocated only, and what we're looking at is the capital construction budget and the capital construction payments on debt, and they are looking at about $60 million or so. And that is only in one segment of the debt, while we're talking about the level of all indebtedness mm-hmm. within the general fund. So that's not necessarily in that way giving the exact amount for what construction would be for higher ed and community colleges versus other stuff. In general, there is plenty of if you also include it in your packet. This is a slide from the presentation that Jack Kenny from DESC gave us, and it has a different projects within the governor's recommended budget that is calling for bond proceeds. And those amounts, you can see where they go to different levels, different venues, if you will. And not necessarily all the those investments are already made, or just the decisions on them are made. And we're trying to allow the committee to give their opinion on what is the top level of all that indebtedness should be, rather than.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
Is it possible to get a chart that looks like this, that's based on the co-chair's recommendations?
It was not possible at this time, I guess.
Mm. It's not possible.
The co-chairs did not look at debt in that sense, but they mostly, it seemed, they looked at debt service. And what that means is debt service starting in 07, 09, you could go into debt for the same amounts, but instead of going into debt in March, let's say, and start paying in the same biennium, you could push it down to April or May, or June for that matter, and start paying Nathan on at the time. So,
the co-chairs didn't look at the total bonded numbers. They looked at the payment side of the equation, basically. So we don't have the ability to compare apples to apples.
That's what I was going to ask Paul to do. Is Paul, if we could get some, based on this chart, which was the conversations I've heard around, is what is our payment, which is obviously this chart. So if we could get maybe based on the figures that you presented of a 5.95 GO, what that would look like, because the greater concern was not what Laura Lockwood McCall talked to us about, at least from what I've heard of, what is our prudent level of debt. What I've heard in the last 4 or 5 days is really the more important conversation, or at least a strong part of that conversation ought to be, what is our debt payments in 07-09, 09-11? And so if we could just get a few models for the committee that would look at, if we picked a 595 figure and put it into Senate Bill 5516, what that would do in terms of this chart, and perhaps pick a couple other numbers, just so that we'll have very clear idea in terms of your apples to apples.
I think, Mr. Chair, part of the avoidance of this is in this chart where you see that the level of debt is kind of given back to the Revenue Committee to determine that, and that's probably what we will be doing. They're obviously not putting the amounts in the construction budget as what will be constructed by debt or using bond proceeds, because that amount that would compare to 2005-07 is what is to be determined by the Revenue Committee, as they were indicating.
Yeah, we're trying to fill that box in.
Mm-hmm. That's the box we're trying to build.
Yeah. Senator Monroe.
I've been thinking about this a lot, and one of the things that in the mix is the action that we took a couple of weeks ago in creating a reserve fund, which should improve our bond rating and save us some on interest. The other thing I'm thinking about is the whole demographic, the fact that we have an aging workforce that are approaching retirement. The so-called baby boomers are in their 50s now, or even up to early 60s, and they're rapidly approaching retirement. That this new generation that's your age has less education than the education level of people my age, which is really troubling. That if we don't gear up to create an educated, trained workforce, then who's going to pay for our retirement?
That's right. It's selfish.
You and Senator Starr have got a long ways to go. Senator George and I, you know, we're getting on the upper end of things. But I have thought about this a lot. As a lifelong educator, I just feel like I am personally willing, especially with the better bond rating, I'm personally willing to take maybe a little bit more risk than I ordinarily would to make sure that we have the education infrastructure, both community college and higher ed, to get that trained workforce that is critical to this state, to this nation's economy in the next 2 or 3 decades. So I'm not saying we should push the envelope clear to the end. I tend to be very prudent when it comes to debt. I understand ratios, and I understand that we need to be careful. But I am willing to go maybe a little beyond the minus 10%, because I feel that there's a crisis coming that we need to be preparing for. And we need to be preparing for it right now. I agree with Senator George that if there is a worse downturn than we can predict, that since these capital projects are over time, that it's possible, and since we're going to be meeting every year instead of every other year, it's possible to make adjustments in this 6-year picture that we're looking at out in the future sometime if things aren't coming into place as we would hope. So generally speaking, that's kind of what my thinking has been, and I would like to see us do what we can in a prudent way to meet the obligations that this institution has to meet the educational needs of our people and for the workforce of the future.
Any economist point of view on that investing versus, I guess you touched on it early, both Paul and Mazin, in terms of the trade-offs that you get of putting some money into to capital, and the obvious trade-off that you have is you have less money to spend on your core programs.
But, you know, of course, the capital, you know, a business purchases capital, or even individuals buy something that's going to last over time. They're going to get those benefits spread out over time, and that's what makes sense in terms of making payments over time to match that flow of benefits. But I think that, you know, the amount of capital that's available for public service it is, that becomes, there is some optimal amount out there that's going to make them as productive as possible given their labor force, and that's, you know, I think that's a key decision.
But played out to the extreme of a state or an entity that was overly conservative in terms of its expenditures and capital, what are there, it'd be just interesting to see any great examples of unsuccessful entities or that just were too conservative in terms of capital and the ramifications of that overly conservative where you just didn't build enough infrastructure.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, in the private sector, of course, you see that if you make those mistakes, it comes back to bite you in a big way. You're not competitive. Your workforce is not as productive as a competitor is, and so you lose market share. They can underprice you or produce a better quality product. In the public sector, it's a little bit more subtle, but you still have this regional competition for economic growth, and where business, you know, where capital is going to locate and where economic growth is going to take place is obviously clearly tied to the quality of public services, and certainly the impact that the public sector has on the quality of the labor force.
Now, Mr. Chair, I think an important thing to keep in mind is, I mean, you could, for example, and we did, by the way, and you will hear later from the higher ed on their investment plans and what they need, but the investments, I mean, you could eventually go and bond, let's say, $2 billion and say, let's take care of everything that there is. However, there is a certain level of capacity when bonding and building and investing starts becoming an obstacle in the process. However, we feel it's probably more important for the process to have the commitment of investing over a longer period of time, that this is what we would be investing over the 6 or 8 years coming, and build that into a process rather than start with a big bang and we primarily don't find enough people to do it, don't have enough firms to, and we have somewhat ran into the same problem with the bridge bonding program with ODOT, that we have all this capacity and the allowance, and we gave this much ability to bond, but we can't build them fast enough, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense, on the investment side, the commitment for investment and development on the longer term, or for a period of time that is defined, is probably as important as the amount that you do in one biennium versus multiple bienniums to come.
Mm-hmm. Questions for Mazin or Paul?
Mr. Chair, it sounds like what Mazin and I need to do is to give you some scenarios related to different debt capacity levels and debt service, what would be a realistic payment, and go out beyond, even really beyond the 6 years, and go out to 10 years. We can make some, we have some basic assumptions we make in terms of long-term growth of the general fund, look at those trends, and then look at, say, a 5% and a 10% below that current projection, and see where that would put you, in both in terms of debt service and in terms of overall capacity.
Well, yeah, and what we can do also is even look deeper and maybe go 20% reduction in terms of the governor's recommendation and just give the committee a good range of debt payments, since that tends to be where folks' eyes have gone, is what are our payments and going to be, and I certainly think that's, at least in the last week, that's what has been requested of me, is to really hone in on that question.
Okay. We need that information.
Thank you very much. We will come back. Laura Lockwood McCall and Jack Kinney and anyone else from the executive branch. I saw Sager in here. I don't see him now. Do you wish to chime in at all as we try to arrive at... You have your newspaper and your...
I always carry the New York Times with me all the time.
Good to have.
I never know when I have. I'll be third up or fourth up on a hearing. You got to have something to do. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of Debt Management in the State Treasurer's Office. I concur with everything I've heard this morning, but if it's all right with the committee, I'd like to just share an observation, having worked in other states and other jurisdictions, that I think part of the reason there's a struggle, both from the operating budget as well as for your committee, is the larger context of a statewide capital plan, which is really just a strategic plan, a strategic investment plan. And so what I've observed in the two sessions now that I've worked here is that there's the governor's proposed budget, but you don't have a context. You don't have the larger, well, what are all the things that we need to do as a state, and where are we headed as a state? And so the budget is the budget and the operating budget, and there's no real guidance. Well, we just give you a capacity. We're not saying, what should the target be? In other words, should debt service as part of the general fund budget be no more than 4% or 5%? If those parameters were built, then people could work backwards and say, okay, what are our highest priorities, given the fact that we can't afford debt service to go above that? And so it would flip the thinking as people are developing their budgets. You may choose to even say, we want to spend out of that 4 or 5%, 25% on higher education, 15% on, I'm making this up, so forgive me, office buildings and, you know, whatever other percentages that this seem appropriate. It seems to me that would give everybody a context to do their planning. Instead, what I've observed is the governor does the governor's budget, and Jack works on that and comes up with their ideas, and then a whole host of bills comes in, and I've got 14 or 15 I just sent off to Mazin yesterday that all have to do with bonding. Some are lottery bonds, some are not, but it seems to me it's a little bit more like a bazaar. And, and you know, that is a process, and perhaps it is a good political process, but it doesn't strike me as being how a corporation or a business would think about its long-term capital needs that were described, that there could be a little bit more standardization and comprehensiveness in the thinking. And so those trade-offs can be made, and ultimately there'll be political trade-offs. But I've worked on capital plan in other jurisdictions, and there were trade-offs. And, you know, at some point certain people's projects move forward and others didn't move back. But I do see a generic struggling with what should we do and how should we proceed, that perhaps setting up a process, once you've laid out parameters for percentages of allocation, perhaps could help.
That's a good observation. Bizarre, certainly feels like a bizarre as we... I was looking at the list of 15 different lottery bond, some of them which I think actually will occur and some may not. But seeing that kind of bizarre, not B-I, but B-A, bizarre atmosphere.
Mr. Chair, you've been today called by Senator Monroe not educated enough.
Mm-hmm.
You're not paying your fair share for the retirement, and now you're being called bizarre.
I don't know how long. Keep this up. And
well, I didn't take any of them. Maybe I should have directed towards myself. Questions for Laura? Any thought... Sarah George.
Laura, I think that's a great idea, and that is to have an actual plan that you're going to work through and do priorities. What kind of structure was that? I mean, that would obviously take legislative action to set up a board or a commission or something that would review that.
Well, we do have a capital projects advisory group that Jack manages, and he can talk about that. My experience was more when I was in working for the state of Virginia. Excuse me, it's called the Commonwealth of Virginia. And we looked around because we were doing debt capacity studies back in the late 80s. And we saw Maryland, and I don't know if other states have done it, but they have a full 10-year capital plan, and you don't necessarily fund everything in the out years, but you have to identify funding sources for how you're going to do things in the out years. And Maryland is a AAA, and where I worked was a AAA. And I think that that's just what better-run organizations tend to do. And I don't know how it would work in the context of our state, but I do think that we certainly could spend the next couple of years looking at different models. I know in county and city government, they tend to do that. We do have a six-year plan for capital through transportation. So if you know anything about the transportation plan, what I'm really suggesting is sort of expanding that in a little bit more comprehensive way for the state as a whole to help folks grapple with these issues, and also to a lot of people who are doing facilities planning to do the planning, because now they never know in advance whether a project is going to make it through or not. And obviously, if it gets shrunk down a whole lot, then it'll be hard to gear back up. I'm going to turn it to...
Can I ask one other question, Laura, and then we'll go right over to Mr. Kinney. So any other observation just on the, I guess, the trade-off that folks' attention seems to be in your area of debt management, not just on that, what are the prudent level, 4% or in terms of lottery, 5% in terms of general fund, that, but what are the, and any observation that you think we ought to be mindful of in terms of what are we eating away at our ability to, and it's really this slide, which I'm not sure if...
It's hard for me to figure out what that slide means, truthfully.
Is it?
So I think we do need...
Just to know that.
Yeah, I think that doesn't say... It just shows what capital... It's an attempt, I think, to begin to say what's the maximum amount you want per biennium. I would just point out that we're giving you maximums in the capacity forecast, not you must do's. In the case of general fund debt service, the maximum we're recommending is 5%. We've been at 3.7% for the last three fiscal years, primarily because revenues have grown to kind of meet that. One decision could be to keep it at about that level or a little bit higher, and then work backwards and say, okay, what does that get you in capacity rather than, and then you could decide the 10 plus or minus. In other words, to take that debt service approach and work backwards.
Okay, so that actually seems like a really good thought to me of helpful for if we just took the 3.7, which we're obviously comfortable with because that is the level that we've basically been at. And Laura, if you could help us.
We could crunch some numbers.
Those numbers of... If we just stay at that 3.7, which is a very comfortable, gets in that whole bazaar environment of how do you maintain at 3.7, what is then your debt capacity on the GO side?
And then we could also say then if it drops by 10%, then what's that number look like? In other words, that's a risk. So we can run that number. As far as lottery, I just
can you put it into a slide?
I'm sure I could.
I think it'd be so helpful. And this is more the in the building to have a slide by slide comparison like this at that 3.7, and then if you did a 10%, let us manage the conversation here.
We have a debt capacity model that forecasts, so you just have to plug in different assumptions to get different answers for the committee. But do remember, the general fund is not just higher ed, but it's also COPs and
some DEQ bonds.
And a few DEQ bonds. And we couldn't tell from the presentation for the co-chairs exactly what was in or was out. My observation for lottery bonds is, again, we're giving you maximums at 4x coverage, but we've been between 8 and 9, 6 to 7, 8 or 9, it's been bouncing around a bit because we've been issuing a lot of lottery bonds, but our revenues have been growing. So that number is a pretty big number in terms of capacity, even compared to what the state's been doing. I think the best way to think about it, again, is how much of your total lottery revenue stream do you ever want to tie it up in terms of debt service? It's a different way than saying capacity. It's more a policy question for the committee to make recommendations. And then once you've sort of figured that out, we can then tell you, okay, if you, based on these revenue forecasts, this is the maximum amount that you're really going to be able to afford. In essence, the Ways and Means co-chairs did that in a way, but whether it's been quantified so people can see what the trade-offs are.
Great.
Okay, so that's something that we can try and do in the next few days.
It'd be really helpful. We need to try to whatever changes we're going to make to these bills, need to get them on by hopefully mid, not Monday, but early to mid April, so that Ways and Means has a chance to reflect upon those and make any changes. So that gives us about 10 days.
I have one last observation, and it plays on what Mazin mentioned earlier, which is if the legislature is moving into annual session, one other choice or something to think about, this is coming straight in my head without processing, is whether to design a different kind of a bond bill. And a bond bill in terms of what you want to see sold in the first year, what you want to see sold in the second year. And that might allow more higher ed projects in the second year with an opportunity for the legislature to take a look-see and to determine, because we'll do an annual debt capacity forecast, and you obviously are getting quarterly revenue forecasts. Is everything the same as we thought the previous year? Mm-hmm. And perhaps that will allow more of the projects that you have before you at the committee to make it into the package so that people can do the planning, and then obviously a second chance to sort of do a little bite at that apple to make sure that our assumptions are still accurate, which might allow us to not have to drop to that minus 10%, but rather stagger. Because in the real world, we're selling most of the bonds from the 2005 legislature. We've been doing them since about January. We've been knocking a lot of them out the door week after week after week, and the debt service really isn't hitting until this upcoming biennium. So there's a little bit more fine-tuning that the legislature could have in terms of how much each year, which could perhaps provide sort of a balance between all the different objectives. But I would point out then, you'll need to know it's going to be in your own 9/11 budget as sort of part of your baseline.
So you've agreed to it in 07 and
exactly. Yeah, so you don't, and that was part of what I was noticing in that chart, was there seems to be sort of the constraint, not just in the 07 and 09, as Mazin mentioned, but it goes out into the 09-11. And so if you do decide to do things in the second year of the biennium, then you have to recognize that you will get the debt service impact in 09-11.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Jack Kenny, Finance Manager, Budget and Management Division, and I think your questions and presentations to the committee and Laura's have covered really the high points quite well. I just have a couple things I'd like to add. One, to echo Senator George's comments, I think what is in the governor's budget is a conservative, prudent target. It's about halfway between the 5% and, between the 10% reduction scenario and the base case. Regarding the comment about the history of the 3.8%, another reason I know during the deliberations of the governor's budget, there was quite a bit of discussion about the backlog, if you will, of deferred maintenance at higher ed. So if we've been doing the 3.8% and we're comfortable with that, I think the committee needs to recognize that that has some ramifications relative to, for instance, backlogs of deferred maintenance at higher education and other state agencies as well. So perhaps we need to consider that as we move forward. Of course, there's new construction needs, but maybe the past debt capacity hasn't really, and not necessarily you had to do it with debt, but you could have done it with, you know, general fund or lottery fund, just straight allocations without debt. But I think Paul Warner made the comment that you try to match benefits with the expenditure streams. So I think bonding for deferred maintenance at the kind of levels that are necessary at higher education is not. Inappropriate, I think it is, and so perhaps because of economic downturns, we've been more conservative in the past than was prudent from a long-term standpoint, and I believe the governor's budget is addressing that by going closer to the
the 5%, even though the 5% goal that the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. So keep that in mind in your deliberations, that we do have something of a backlog that we need to address, and maybe 3.8 is a good long-term number, perhaps, but I think we're kind of making up for some lost time here, or at least that was the governor's thinking in preparing his budget. So I would keep that in mind. In addition, Mazin talked about the list that I gave you when I was last before this committee or two times ago and gave you those items that were in the governor's budget. I think Laura and maybe some of the people, I think Paul also alluded to, there are other items that are probably going to get added to this. And of course, as, you know, to use Laura's term, the bazaar of the trading, that's obviously part of the process, and we respect that. Certainly there are things in the governor's budget that I'm sure the legislature will continue, things like upgrading the legislative wings. I think there was a hearing on that the other day.
Easy, Jack.
those numbers aren't in the governor's budget, and so if it's the pleasure of the legislature that move forward, you're going to have enough capacity to address that as well. I'm sure there are other very worthwhile projects that have come up since the governor's budget was prepared that need to be considered. Finally, I think there was the discussion about timing of the projects and the bond sales. You know, we do need to be careful about flooding the market and doing all the bond sales at once. That's going to increase the cost, even though getting a reserve might decrease our cost, potentially. I'm not sure that Oregon is a big enough player that could happen, but it's a potential that we need to keep in mind. And the project needs. Some of these projects really can't wait until later in the biennium. So bring that up. But I think you all have already addressed the issue that even if you pushed them all to the end of the biennium and had zero debt service, Mazin said you could issue them all in June. Perhaps you could, and you'd have no debt service for 2007-09. But the roll-up costs are still going to be there. So if you're really going to be responsibly looking at this, you really need to look at the roll-up costs. Finally, and this is a technical point, but just to let you know, when the debt capacity model is built by the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, they look at the last 5 years of debt costs. And I think that's appropriate for what they're doing. When we build the governor's budget, we're a little more conservative than that. You need to make sure that you've got enough debt service in the budget if case interest rates go up. And perhaps the rates have been going up slightly over the last 5 years. So what you'll get from the debt capacity model might be slightly different than what I would recommend to you if I was saying build a budget, because you need to look at what your costs are going to be when you sell bonds in 2007-09, what the history has been. So just a point of clarification. And that's probably... I think that probably hits things that I would like to add to this discussion.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Kinney. Questions for this panel? Certainly seems to me that it could be refined and a better capital management plan longer term, because I think just the nature of having a 93% discrepancy between the executive and at least the first kind of whack at it just gives you great, I think, evidence that somehow to be 93% off means you've got two completely different conversations occurring. Senator Monroe.
A couple of comments. Community colleges have had a very difficult time getting any capital needs met from the voters and property taxes. For a number of reasons, not the least of which is the double majority rule. We are working on a modification of the double majority rule, but that'll have to go to the voters because it's in the Constitution. So it will be a couple of years before that would take effect, even under the best scenario. So, as a result, I know specifically Mount Hood Community College facility has deteriorated dramatically, that we're getting further and further behind in terms of upkeep, maintenance. So it's not just the need for new buildings, but it's a need for maintenance. I'm sure that facilities all around the state are in a similar situation. That's something we need to be aware of. I'm looking forward to seeing the numbers that you can produce, because I would like to see exactly how the co-chair's budget compares to the governor's budget. I tend to agree with Senator George that the governor's budget level is probably pretty responsible. We need to look at that. We need to hopefully
really attack this, both short-term and long-term. I really believe, and I appreciate the fact you brought it up as well, that being able to look at these numbers annually instead of once every 2 years, and prospectively, budgets are prepared almost 3 years before they're actually completely take effect. I think that's going to be very, very helpful. I've always argued for over 20 years that it was really not responsible to only meet once every 2 years when we're planning that far out. It makes it very, very difficult to do the people's work correctly. And so I think the brief even year session that we're planning for next year and hopefully will continue is going to really help us to fine-tune the decisions that we make based on whether the economy is continuing to grow or whether it's slumping a bit.
Thank you. Someone has their cell phone on, and it's the noise that you hear in the mics. George of the Higher Ed System, and we'll give Community College the same shot, and then we'll close this work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, George Bernsteiner, Chancellor of the University System. I'm joined here with Bob Simon, the Director of Capital Projects for OUS. Bob has a brief presentation to go through that Mr. Malik had requested that kind of puts this in context of the kinds of things that we do and what the best practices around the country might be with regard to investment in higher education facilities. And then I'd like to close our discussion with a little more of a sort of the economic effect of some of these things that we are proposing to do, if that would be all right with you.
Great.
Thank you, George. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Simonton. I'm Director of Capital Construction for the Oregon University System. And it's my pleasure to come before you today and discuss our capital budget request, and in particular, the question that Mazen had posed to us that is shown on slide 2 of the handout we were given, which is, how do we determine the essential budget level for our campuses? Now, the state has made a sizable investment in higher education facilities, and we've evaluated each project, and they were based on a criteria in 7 categories to determine our most critical needs. Now, the repair of our existing facilities is clearly our top priority, but to effectively serve our growing and changing population of students, we must also address program improvements, new facilities, and targeted investments for economic growth. And we have several industry standards we'd like to share with you to sort of put our request in the proper context. If we jump to slide 3, I want to explain the magnitude of our capital repair needs and show you a few slides to highlight how we managed to grow our backlog to $640 million. Now, unlike the rest of state government, higher education facilities were mainly constructed within a small 15-year window between 1960 and 1975, and this was mainly to address the baby boomers entering college that Senator Monroe had mentioned earlier. Now, although the buildings are designed to last 100 years or more, the building subsystems, like the electrical, the HVAC, the roofs, only last 30 to 40 years. So now we jump ahead to 2007, and most of those building subsystems have aged to a point where they're past due for renewal and are failing. So then we jump to slide 4. We have an industry standard for what we should be spending annually.
What were the red bars indicating on slide 3?
Slide 3, the red bars, I'm sorry, are the square footage of the buildings that were constructed from 1960 to 1975. And those buildings were constructed to respond to all the students entering our system, the baby boomers. And that occurred nationwide as well.
Senator Church.
That was probably done with substantial bonding.
It was done mainly with state bonding. State general fund matched with state G bonds.
That's before you had the private match.
Correct. I believe it was not until 1993 that we began with the gift match to the G bonds. So on slide four, we have an industry standard that tells us the amount we should be spending on an annual basis for capital repairs, and that is between 1.5% to 3% of the total replacement value of our physical plant. And the value of our education and general facilities is about $2.8 billion. So that range for OUS is about $84 million to $168 million per biennium that we should be spending to keep the backlog from growing any larger. And the graph on slide four shows you how we've done since 1975 in addressing our capital repair needs. And you see the red line is the backlog that has grown over time to the $640 million level. And then on slide five, we have another way of measuring how well our facilities are performing based on that lack of funding. We have APA and NACUBA are our benchmarks, which are nationally recognized organizations in higher ed. You see the scale that over the facility condition index is what's wrong with the building divided by the current replacement value. And that ratio, we have the scale, anything over 10% is considered poor. And the OUS facility condition index is currently at 23%, which is much higher than, much worse than poor.
I'm sorry. So APA, and those are just organizations I'm not, do they come in and rate your buildings, or they have the standard and then someone else comes and says, an independent, it's not your, I guess A, the question is, it's not the university system that says, this is APA and NACUBA, doesn't meet the APA and NACUBA standard.
You're correct. APA and NACUBA jointly formed a commission that studied the facility condition index and came up with this model. And then the Oregon University System in 2001 hired a consulting firm, Pacific Partners, to assess all of our buildings to determine what is our facility condition index.
In 01.
For me?
That was 6 years ago.
That's correct.
I'm the worst today.
Chairman, don't get better.
This is then on slide six. The $83.5 million proposed in the governor's budget represents the low end of the industry standard for capital repair, but that level will keep the backlog from growing any larger than it has currently. It's currently at $640 million. And to address the backlog, there is no industry standard for funding, but we've proposed a 20-year plan to reduce the backlog. Other states, for example, have initiated large bond levies to address the problem. I think North Carolina passed a $5 billion bond levy to address their deferred maintenance. So there's other examples of states that have done that.
They're just a one big...
Knock it out and be done with it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
So that was interesting, what you just said. So they did a statewide... I mean, we do bond levies for local school districts all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was North Carolina?
Yeah, North Carolina, Virginia.
They did a statewide, basically, bond levy that you would do to build new high schools, new elementary schools.
Correct.
Interesting.
Who put that on the ballot? Do you know? Was it just the legislature that would put those on the ballot? Or
I'm not sure, Senator Decker, but
would that have to go on the ballot?
Or you just do... I'm sure it does. I mean, we have...
We'd have to have the interplay with that, Measure 5, Measure 15.
If it's against property tax, then it, of course, bonding is outside the limit.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
And then on slide 7, the next national standard relates to improvements for academic and research facilities. And the national standard for that is 0.5 to 1.5% of the current replacement value of the physical plant. So that translates to a range for OUS to between $28 million and $84 million per biennium, and $53 million is what is proposed in the governor's recommended budget.
Who sets that national standard for?
It goes back to basically APA, the Association of Physical Plant Directors. It's just an average that's been calculated, similar to the Facility Condition Index.
Okay.
Sort of a rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm. Whoever has their cell phone on, it's continuing to ring, by the way.
Mr. Chair, this is the amount that continues every year. If you do it, it will maintain no degradation in the plants, right? That's status quo.
The facility, if we go back to slide 6, the $83.5 million would keep everything constant. If we had no deferred maintenance and we spent $83.5 million, that would keep that in check. And every dollar below that is not spent adds to the backlog. And a few slides previous, we had shown that since 1975, we showed that difference between what was required versus what was actually adopted. So you can see that the backlog has grown over a long period of time.
Sir George.
We had a lot of emphasis in the legislature on preparedness, particularly seismic impacts.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed you noted that on page 6. My question is that when you're looking at buildings, you guys are probably evaluating this on the fact, if I bring this up to the standard of seismic preparedness, is it better, or are we better off just to replace the building? And what are you finding as you look at the bulk of our buildings? In other words, kind of like a percentage would be better off to be replaced because of seismic consideration than to be repaired.
Senator George, we actually have three criteria that we use to look at our buildings. The one is the Facility Condition Index, how bad off are the subsystems in that building. We also look at seismic. In fact, we worked with DAGAMI, the Department of Geological Mineral Industries, and FEMA, where we helped sort of revamp how they assess buildings nationwide seismically, where we've come up with a model that looks at the probability of collapse versus whatever crazy logarithmic mess that they had before. So now we can take the Facility Condition Index, a seismic index, and we also look at an energy savings component index that we've created. We put all those three together, and we come up with the worst of the worst of our buildings. So we have in our budget, you'll see the very worst building is Lincoln Hall. And that was a tough choice. Do we save that building? Because it is a high collapse risk. Everything in it is beyond repair. The deferred maintenance list is maxed out. But there is a great potential for energy savings. And it's was Portland State's first building. So there's other considerations, historic value. If there was no historic value and no real true feelings with the building, I would recommend demolishing it. As PCAT building, we looked at that building, and that is one building that we will be demolishing in the near future here. So there are buildings that don't quite make it to the list that we plan to demolish.
Can you do a follow-up on
this?
Last session, we were dealing with the state mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And during that presentation in the building, we had the lead engineer who had analyzed the building, and he was describing a set of conditions. And so I asked him, I said, are you telling me that these floor structures that are, you know, piled up here, that they're literally just hanging off of a protrusion off of that brick wall? And the answer was yes. And so I asked this question. Would you spend one night in that building? And the answer was no. Now, that just shook me to my very core. And so the next question I asked was, well, if the state hospital's like that, how many other buildings do we have that are so seismically at risk? And do we have any buildings on the university system that would resemble that, where we do not? We do. Oh, maybe I shouldn't ask that question.
Strike
that from the
record. But let me respond. If you go back to slide 3, where when all of our buildings were constructed, there's a sort of yellow bar at the top that says there was no state building code until 1974. So you can see most of our buildings were constructed without that benefit. To the right of that is when the seismic code was updated. That was in 1993. So you can imagine pretty much all of our buildings have not had the benefit of that knowledge of the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake that looms off of our coast. So that's why it's so expensive to fix all of our buildings, because number one, you have to address the life safety codes that were never implemented into the building to begin with. Then you also have to deal with the seismic retrofits that were never implemented into the building. So we have quite a few buildings that are in need of seismic upgrade. And we estimated that to be about $400 million worth of repairs.
Slide 7? Or is that it?
I think, George, if you want to...
In the interest of time, I guess we'll move on. I think you have an idea that we actually pay a lot of attention to the condition of our buildings. We pay a lot of attention and devote a lot of effort to figuring out on a very systematic basis what their condition is and to bring forward to you those that are in the worst need. And that, in fact, is a goodly portion of our capital construction request. And another portion that we talked about the last time dealt with the new requirements which we're trying to meet, both for workforce development, for example, the Oregon Institute of Technology's building for healthcare technologists, and also for research and innovation in the sciences at both the University of Oregon and Oregon State University. I was thinking about this a little bit last night. One of the things that characterized our economy after World War II were ideas, invention, technology, innovation, and they all were founded on education. They all were founded on improving the level of education, which had been viewed as good enough in the 1930s, to a much higher level by the time we got into the 70s and the 80s. And we know now that we are in another period like that, where the level of education of our adult population will determine the success of our state economically and in many other ways. I may have mentioned at the last hearing that I had the opportunity to meet with Craig Barrett, who's the chairman of Intel, a couple months ago. And he said to the group of educators that he was with that, in fact, as far as he was concerned, worldwide, those economies that will do the best will have the highest level of education. That the education level of the adult population is directly related to the economic success of any economy in the world in the future. Mm-hmm. That's important for us because as we look at what we're trying to do with these buildings, we're trying to build the success of Oregon in the 21st century, to increase the economic viability of this state and of its citizens. We can talk a lot, and I will talk briefly, about the direct economic impact of construction on our economy. I spent a little time, endured, I think is the word I used at the time, a lot of effort in the 1960s when I was younger, and a graduate student at the University of Washington with the guy who sort of invented input-output analysis, which is sort of the base case for how you do multipliers. It was much more tedious in those days, I have to admit. And one of the things that occurred to me is we could kind of put a multiplier on the kinds of things that we're talking about here. Not just the construction, but all the things that we're doing here. You know, we mentioned last time there are about 5,500 construction jobs associated with the work that we're proposing in the governor's recommended budget for capital construction for OUS. At a very conservative multiplier, I don't believe in the 5 and 7 multipliers. I believe in the 1.8 and 2.4s. I will just disclose that going in. At a very conservative multiplier on construction, we could be looking over the construction cycle in just state taxes generated of about $60 million just for that activity alone. The Kelly Engineering Building was mentioned by Ed Ray as an example of what has been done in the past. And it's an example that I think is important because we have two projects, the one at U of O, the Integrated Science Building, and the one at OSU, the Linus Pauling Institute. They're very analogous to what will happen with that has happened with the Kelly Building. As you recall, the Kelly Building involved a $20 million gift and $20 million in state bonds. That's a gift that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise. That's money that would not have been spent in Oregon. That's construction that wouldn't have happened in Oregon without that gift and without the state match. And that generated during its construction period, conservatively, with, again, a conservative multiplier effect on construction, about $2.7 million in state taxes. We have enough gifts in this budget that the gifts alone, with the economic activity that they will bring, would generate more than $11 million of state taxes during the construction cycle. That's not to be ignored as we think about the economic impact. But really, that's not the long-term impact. That's sort of a get-through, get-by, getting-through-the-construction-cycle impact. What about the longer term? The Kelly Building has helped OSU faculty to be able to attract $4 million per year of funded research from the feds they could not have conducted otherwise because they didn't have a place to do it. $4 million a year of other people's money is coming into Oregon that otherwise would not have. And in fact, that will generate additional state taxes over a biennium with, again, a conservative multiplier, even more conservative than the construction. That would be probably over $700,000. Now, will that pay the debt service on Kelly, which is about $2.5 million a biennium? No. But there are other benefits to an educated citizenry. There are other benefits to having the research being conducted than that. Because what you also have with Kelly and what you will have with the science buildings that we're talking about at U of O, OSU, and PSU is generating innovation, generating business. When we were down at the Kelly Building with our board meeting a couple months ago, we had the opportunity to have both faculty and staff presenting to us about what they were doing in that building. And one of the students came forward and he says, you know, I'm a graduate student here, and I've started a business. And I've now hired 8 other graduate students here, and we're doing business based on the research we did because we had access to that lab in this new building. That business is in Oregon. That business will generate jobs and will generate tax revenue for this state. And that business could not have happened if we hadn't had the facility available for the research to be conducted at Oregon State University. And we will be able to have stories like that for U of O, for OSU, for PSU, for these kinds of things going forward. Let's talk about the OIT building a minute.
Senator George has a question.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm going to run up to the governor's office in just a second. How many of the $83 million in gift pledges are conditioned upon us matching those dollars? Because we really are conscious of whether we lose, you know, a federal dollar or we lose some other thing because of the fact that we don't step up to the plate. Are any of those conditioned upon the fact that the state would come in with additional money?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think all of them have the implicit understanding that the state will match. That's part of the ask. It's that we will try to get state match if you will give us your match. I mean, it's the chicken and egg thing that I think Ed Ray talked about when we were here last time. So it's directly tied.
And that is uniform in terms of when a prospective donor is there will be a state match or that is...
It's usually, Senator Deckard, usually the way it's phrased is we will attempt to get a state match, if you will. It's one of those things where if you, then I, and you hope that the gift will come regardless. But sometimes you're skating on thin ice with it. We have not yet, to my knowledge, returned any monies, but I don't know that we wouldn't have to at some future time on some project. I'll just close briefly with two more examples, one OIT and one PSU. And the OIT example, you know, we are proposing to build a healthcare workforce building that will allow OIT to increase by 75 graduates per year the health technologists that they will be putting into the economy primarily of rural Oregon, in Klamath Falls. the earning capacity of just those 75 people each and every year is going to generate additional economic development and additional taxes for the state. Think about that. Even beyond the fact that they will be filling a social need for the state, a health care need for the state, they're also generating income for themselves and for back for the state, because they will have that level of knowledge and expertise in the marketplace that will help serve Oregon in many ways. And finally, at PSU, Lincoln Hall, Bob mentioned Lincoln Hall is the one in the worst shape. Lincoln Hall is on a it's open on the sufferance of the city of Portland. They had it under a conditional use permit, saying you got to fix it. We've band-aided it and band-aided it for years. We're hopeful that they will allow us to continue to operate that building. If this project is not funded, and if the city says no, we've run out of patience and we don't think it's safe enough to operate, or if we decide it's not safe enough to operate, we're going to be taking down around 12.5% to 13% of the classroom capacity of the largest university in the state. We do not have any place for those students to go. And if you begin to reduce by 400 to 500 degrees a year the number of degrees you're generating at Portland State University, the impact on the economy, the impact on this state in a very short period of time is going to be substantial. And so I ask you to think about three kinds of impact as you look at this. The first is the impact directly at terms of construction. Yes, there is some. But also the impact of an educated citizenry and of the research and commercialization of research that can occur because of what's happening in these buildings. Those have long-term 20, 30, 40, 50-year effects on this state, and all of those are positive effects. And so I would urge you, as you consider where to draw that line on the debt limit, to think that if you draw it too low, you won't have this economic activity, and it becomes then a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think instead we need to think about what the future can be rather than what the future might be if we didn't invest. So thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor. Questions for the Chancellor or... Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate the quick turnaround on that. That'll help us. Community colleges, do y'all have scanning? Andrea, did you want to? Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. Thanks for this opportunity. I'll be very brief, but I think that George Kernsteiner did an excellent job of really hitting the economic benefits of the capital construction. And to just put a little bit of a community college spin on it, because we do serve a slightly different population than the university system. In community colleges, we're really focused right now on trying to plan strategically for Oregon's future. We know that there is a huge need for an educated workforce. So it's not just the four-year degrees, but increasingly jobs out there require a certificate or a professional technical degree of some sort to have a well-paying family wage job. And frankly, right now, we can't meet that capacity. There are still going jobs in the state that are unfilled, because there's not a trained person that can fill that job. And so our project list really is designed around how do we build that capacity for Oregon's future. There's two key components of that capacity. One is making sure that there is opportunity to post-secondary education in areas of the state that currently don't have that access. Of our projects, there's two key projects that fit that need. One is in Hermiston, which is a rapidly growing area. And the project is a joint project with the OUS system to have a post-secondary facility in Hermiston so that the people in that rapidly growing area have more access to help that economic development. The other project is in McMinnville so that there is a post-secondary facility in McMinnville to serve the rapidly growing Yamhill County. The other big area of our projects really is around workforce training. One of the key needs right now is in the healthcare industry. We've done a great job of increasing the capacity to train nurses, but there are many others in the healthcare fields that also need to be trained, the technicians, phlebotomists, rad techs. I mean, there's a whole list of those that there are jobs out there. There's going to be an increasing number of jobs, and we don't have the facilities right now to train them. About 9 of our projects have an allied health component to it, both in terms of the lab space and the actual training space for those programs. To give you one specific example, in Lane Community College, the program that the building that they would build would allow them to expand their allied health offerings. One area that they serve is in dental hygiene. Right now, dental hygienists, the average state salary is $70,000. These are very well-paying jobs, but we need to increase our capacity to actually train those people. Many of those also will have an increase in science labs that serve the needs not just for the allied health but for many other jobs as well, both professional, technical, and for those that are seeking to get their 2-year degree at community colleges to transfer to a 4-year degree. We have a problem with science labs around the state and have waiting lists. That is key to Oregon's economic future, is to have that training in the math and sciences, and so we have our projects that will expand those capacities. As you're looking at the overall economic impact and looking at debt service and what portion of the state budget should go to debt service as opposed to actually paying the programs, I would ask you to also look at the economic impact of those jobs that will be trained and what that multiplier will be in the long term on the state, because it's not just the construction of those projects, but it's that long-term infrastructure so that we can train. In the allied health area, the projection is by 2014 we'll have an additional 47,000 jobs to fill. All of those require training. That's both because of retirements and because of new jobs that will be created. We're nowhere near meeting that capacity. And so this is a really important step to build to that capacity. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the community college projects.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. Questions for Ms. Henderson? Thank you.
Thank you.
So we are completed. We will schedule this one more time and hope to bring to the committee both the graphs and the charts, but also formal amendments. And those should not take long because they're just number amendments and won't. So I don't think we'll have an LC, but we'll try to do that in the next 10 days to have this back and scheduled.
Good.
Questions? We are adjourned until Monday of next week when we go into all the incentives that are out there, or many of the incentives and tax credits that are out there, we'll start in on next week. Close the work session on Senate Bill 5516, close the work session on Senate Bill 152, and adjourn.